Hello, I am Lieutenant Colonel Sam Padman from the Centre for Australian Army Leadership. Welcome back to the Australian Army Leadership podcast series, the official podcast for the Centre itself. On this episode of the Australian Army Leadership podcast series, we are very fortunate to be joined by our first non-uniformed guest, Dr. Gemma King, who joins us today via phone from Queensland. Gemma, welcome and thank you for your time today.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
Excellent. Hey, Jen, before we get into it today, I might just take an opportunity now to potentially slightly embarrass you, but more importantly, introduce you further to our listeners and then take them through some of the topics we'll discuss today.
So, okay, go for it.
Thank you. Ladies and gents, Dr. King is the founder and director of BioPsych Analytics, a company specialising in advanced human performance optimisation. Gemma has been a consultant to Defence, the Australian Institute of Sport, the Olympic swim team, and is also a research fellow at UQ and a lecturer to Sydney Uni MBA program. Gemma has previously worked with us here at the Centre for Australian Army Leadership as both a guest speaker at our 2019 Australian Army Leadership Symposium, which can be found on The Cove for our listeners who have access to The Cove as well. And Gem also came and supported us at our Advanced Leadership and Human Performance Seminar, which we held late last year up at Kokoda Barracks. Today, we are very fortunate to have Dr. King on the show. We're going to cover five topics today. You know, those topics are, firstly, understanding the neurobiology of effective teaming. We'll then explore establishing rapid trust, rapport and psychological safety. We'll talk about managing stress as a team in volatile, uncertain, complex and ambiguous environments, something that will be, I suppose, central to where we're going in an accelerated warfare environment and what the future operating scene or battle space could look like. I'm then going to ask Dr. King about her thoughts on what prohibits inter-team cohesion, some ways we might get around that, and some hints and tips for our listeners. And then finally, to finish off, because everything we do well as a team, I'm going to ask Dr. King on her thoughts. What are the top five factors to increase inter-team effectiveness? So quite a jam-packed podcast today. Gemma, thank you again, and I look forward to the conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah, lots of really interesting topics.
Excellent. Hey, Jen, we might jump straight into it. If I can, I suppose I'll lead the conversation to start with. I'll pose a question for you. Look, turning now to the topics we've got at hand, arguably in leadership, there's no more important factor than reciprocal trust between the leader and the follower. Now, this sounds simple, but as we know in practice, it's much more complicated to learn how to interact with others in a way that increases trust. But importantly, how do we also avoid behaviours that may destroy it?
Yes, Sam, you're so right.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. So I suppose over to you, how do we get after that? You know, how do we really establish that trust and rapport and then enhance it moving forward?
Yeah, you're really right. I mean, trust is incredibly precious and it's so fragile. Mm. And I think without it, you just really can't build a high-functioning team. So, yeah, I'm going to talk about that. There's some basic formulas that you can use to engender trust in yourself as a leader, but also, yep, you know, how you can get the team to trust each other. And then how do you build rapport with like external teams? So what I think is really important is to understand some basics about our evolutionary history, yep, and the vital role that teams had for survival of the human race. And in doing so, like, it gives you context about why do our brains and our neurochemistry work the way they do. So I'm just going to go back, you know, 200,000 years and to when, you know, humans started to evolve when they stood up, you know, as Homo sapiens and got into teams or, yep, tribes. And, you know, back then, being part of a tribe was really an essential factor for survival. Like, if you could just imagine if you were some, you know, skinny, lone savanna bushman, like, you would have been, yep, really easy lunch for a saber-toothed tiger or whatever was going to eat you back then.
Of course.
But, you know, if a bunch of you got together and cooperated and you started chucking rocks simultaneously, you became like a formidable organized fighting force. Yeah, and I think, yeah, that's what makes humans being part of a group so effective. So when you think about it, you know, we develop some really clever neural architecture and some biochemistry that helps us navigate through group life and helps us cooperate with others and, you know, understand what others are thinking and feeling. And then it helps us manage the dynamics of the group. And really the point of it is so you remain part of this group and you remain part of the team and the tribe. Because, you know, the only way to survive back then was to be part of a group.
Of course.
You know, I'm just going to talk about a really important part, and this is something to remember when we talk about modern teams, is that if you were expelled from a group, this meant certain death. And, you know, back then it was a lonely, you know, probably pretty morbid and violent death.
Yeah.
So, you know, our brains have developed this, you know, hard wiring to constantly scan the environment for in-group and out-group indicators. So, like, you know, am I in? Am I safe? Am I accepted? Am I going to be, you know, fed and protected? Or am I going to get rejected? And, you know, for your primitive brain, that's kind of like a mortal threat.
Yeah, okay, so it's sort of imprinted on the brain back then, but also still now to an extent.
Yeah, like we still have this very, you know, primitive ancient hardware in our modern skulls. And I think what people don't realise, and particularly leaders, is that humans spend a huge amount of time and cognitive resources sort of analysing our place in social, in the social hierarchy and our relationships with others.
Yeah, okay.
And I think there's an article in the Journal of Human Nature, and they found that 70% of what we talk about is actually related to social matters, and that the reason we've got such a big prefrontal cortex is just precisely to house all of this social information.
Right.
Yeah. So, and further to that point, we have this really potent social threat detection mechanism. So when we perceive that we're potentially out of a team, it triggers your amygdala. And so this is a part of your brain responsible for the threat response. And this is when you set off that chain of hormones and chemical reactions that make your body ready to flee or to fight, you know, potentially alone in a dangerous world. So another really fascinating point on this is that, and it's super important to remember as a leader, is that, you know, neuroimaging studies have shown that the parts of our brain that light up when we detect rejection are the same parts of our brain involved in physical pain. Yeah, it's, I mean, you know you're feeling when you get rejected. It actually hurts. You know, you feel it in your chest. And so this is basically, you know, Mother Nature's way of saying, stop what you're doing, do something different, or you're going to be booted. And it stops us from being like an annoying loser and, you know, turns us, you know, stops us from being a loner, which is going to end up being a dead loner. There's research to show that if you ever get dumped by your partner, they say, take Panadol because it actually works on the same parts of the brain as physical pain.
Don't go taking
the whole packet or anything, but just, you know.
that's fascinating. So it's a built-in mechanism that we've got. We've always had it and it's still there today.
Yeah. So basically, you know, this is, you know, going back to your question about, you know, how does a leader build trust? Why does this matter? Well, we know that, you know, trust can be lost in a second.
Of course.
It's very, you know, it's primitive and it's not always logical, but it goes back to this hardwired innate primitive neurobiology. And when you know this, it kind of helps you. And there's actually a formula or what we call a set of necessary preconditions that exist in order for people to be able to trust you.
Yeah, okay.
And, yeah, there's a few academic variations, but the basics to remember is A, B, C.
Yeah, okay.
And so I'm going to go through what they mean. So just remember A, B, C.
A is
ability or competency. So this is when, you know, your team, your subordinates want to know that you actually have the skills and the experience to lead the team.
Sure, of course.
They want to know that you know what you're doing.
It's your competence, isn't it, as well, if I could look at it that way?
Yeah, it's just pure, it's competency. And then there's B for benevolence. So this is where you display that you genuinely care about the team.
Yep.
And then the C is consistency and reliability. And so basically that you're going to do the things you say you're going to do and you're going to do it on a regular basis.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, in, when you're talking about consistency, really interesting fact that people would rather that you're consistently grumpy than inconsistently kind.
Yeah, okay, that's fascinating. So instead of when something happens, you know, you go from your normal state through a conflict sequence into a totally different person, which is probably almost unpredictable. What you're saying there, if I can sort of read back to you, is people would like to be able to, I suppose, predict you more, or you're a more, I don't know.
Yeah, people want to know what they're going to get. They want to know that if I do this, he's going to do that.
Of course.
People don't know that creates an enormous amount of uncertainty in your brain and actually creates stress hormones and, you know, does a whole lot of negative things to your cognition. But, you know, just going back to that formula, to be an effective leader, those things need to come in a specific order. So, Sam, can you guess out of the A, B, and C which one needs to come first?
I'm gonna throw an absolute guess at this one, but A, because it's first in the alphabet?
No, but that's, I mean, that's usually the response you get. People okay, think, okay, yep, as a leader, I've got to come across as competent.
Yeah, of course.
And that I've got to demonstrate my abilities. But actually, it's B.
Oh, right. Okay.
Warmth, yeah.
Wow.
And I'll tell you why. There's heaps of research and there's a primitive neurobiological reason why. So this all, you know, comes off the back of Harvard professor Amy Cuddy. So she's done a whole lot of research on this. And basically warmth must become before displays of competence because, like, I don't know if you've heard the old adage, no one cares about how much you know until they know how much you care.
Yes, I have, yeah.
Yeah, it's true because what happens when people come across a new situation or a new person or a leader, their brain does three things, okay? So this is all subconscious, but and every brain, human brain does this. So they ask, A, are you dangerous?
Yeah.
You know, are you going to hurt me? And then once they're satisfied that, no, you're not dangerous, they'll ask themselves, B, can you be one of us? Are you like me?
Yeah, okay.
And then only once that, you know, you've satisfied those two questions can people assess whether or not you're competent.
Right.
Because these are fundamental basic needs to know. Are you going to hurt me? Are you one of me? And only then do I care whether you can do stuff well.
Right, yeah, fascinating.
So, as a leader, it's really important to remember that warmth should always come before competence. And because if you're like high warmth and high competence, what that does, it results in admiration. And so you're actually perceived as a charismatic leader.
Yep.
But if you are one of those leaders that portray high competence but low warmth, research has shown, and anecdotally you might know this yourself, it creates envy and not very likable. People may respect you, but they may not want to follow you.
And so,
this is like the, you know, the high tech guy that you need, but you wouldn't, you know, ask him out for a beer or something.
No, certainly. So you're really talking there, Jem, to the human touch and the human endeavour aspect of leadership there itself. So whilst you still need to have be sound of character as a leader, be competent in your role, you know, it's really about having that human understanding as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, don't get me wrong, you need to demonstrate competency. Like, you don't want to be that really high, warm guy, low competency, who's like the, you know, the nice guy who, you know, everyone sort of takes pity on.
Yes.
And you don't want to be that low warmth, you know, high competence person, which is, you know, the competent asshole, or you don't want the incompetent asshole. So it's really important to just establish that first and then comes next, because people's brains are scanning the environment and they actually can't see technical, they can't hear technical information, you know, instructions, if that primitive part of the brain hasn't been sort of soothed and satisfied.
Yeah, fantastic.
So, yeah, and also, like, you've got to remember as a leader that emotional contagion is a very potent phenomenon, and that how you show up as a leader and what you give off is super contagious, particularly when you're in a stressful situation.
Right.
So it's really important to set your emotional state before you go into a situation where you're going to need to influence people, because whatever you're feeling, they're going to get it. It's very potent.
Is it really you rubbing off on them as the leader? You know, and it goes back to the point we spoke about before with conflict sequence, you know, how emotional you get or how you may overreact to a situation then has a direct, you know, effect on the people working with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Jim, you've raised some fantastic points. If I can talk a little bit about the trust side of the house. You know, you spoke to trust as a formula that's key for teams. You know, another way, I suppose, to talk about it is trust as a dividend. You know, the more trust you have, the higher the dividends, the quicker jobs or tasks or mission sets get done. But conversely as well, the less trust you have, the lower the dividend. And I think we can all look at our workplace and say, isn't it funny, those who I trust, I can talk with openly, we seem to get jobs done quickly, we don't need to have as many orders or details, but then those we don't trust, it takes twice as long to do the same thing. So with that then, you know, as an army, you know, we spoke about the ABC approach to it, and I've got a good baseline understanding now. I'll go away and keep doing some more work on it. But how else might we really get about, you know, fostering trust, especially when we focus heavily on mission requirements and mission outcomes?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's super important that, you know, trust is a funny thing. It's like a reciprocity. If you demonstrate that you trust individuals, they will become trustworthy. So yep. It's almost you have to make yourself a little bit vulnerable, give a bit, and then take a risk. And then let them demonstrate that they are trustworthy. But if you come in and not trusting people automatically, they won't demonstrate that they're trustworthy. Yeah, and this goes to, you know, one concept that's really gained prominence lately across, you know, organisational behaviour across many organisations. And it's the concept of psychological safety.
Okay, yeah.
So I know there's probably concrete thinkers out there that are going, oh, sounds a bit fluffy, you know, blah, blah, blah. But actually, the concept of psych safety is critical for high-performing teams. And actually, Google, after doing like this really hardcore deep dive analysis in what made their teams effective, like they analysed hundreds and thousands of data points,
yeah,
they found that psych safety was the most predictive factor for team success. And this was above coding skills or anything else.
Oh, okay. Can you sort of explain a bit more in detail psychological safety, what it might look like?
So, like, we know that psychological safety, it's a belief that the environment you're in or the context you're in is safe for risk-taking.
Okay.
So if you know that you can speak up with ideas or questions or concerns, or you can even highlight the mistakes of a leader, and that's going to be welcomed and valued, and it's not going to lead to negative repercussions for that team member.
Yeah, okay, yep.
Yeah, and so, you know, the research has shown that, and Google found that psychologically safe teams way outperformed non-safe teams by a long shot. And so it's basically a fancy way of saying group trust.
Right, and, okay.
Yeah, so trust is between, like, two people, but psych safety is between the group. And
gotcha. This
is, like, a super important concept, particularly in industries where there's high risk involved. So you're thinking about aeronautical, medical, or nuclear, or military.
Yes.
You know, you really need to ensure psych safety, you know, particularly because, you know, for Army, they've got this requirement that often puts its members into unsafe situations. So if you think back to yourself, like all the dangerous environments where you've been in where things can go terribly wrong.
Yeah.
Like, imagine if there's people who saw it coming but, like, didn't say anything or didn't feel safe to, and then someone gets hurt or even someone dies. Like, this is a problem. And so as a leader, fostering psych safety is really critical because, you know, Army's going to be a dangerous place, and you can make it less dangerous if you allow people to speak up without fear of retribution, feeling like it's safe to do so.
Well, yeah, of course. So it becomes paramount then. And if I can, you know, we're really talking there that the leader needs to set the environment, right? You know, look at the group, understand the group, set an environment where that trust can build, and therefore the psychological safety comes in it. But I suppose as the follower as well, is them being empowered enough to be able to speak up or to have their say.
Yeah, Absolutely.
Fantastic. Jim, if I can, while I've got some time here, you know, some leaders may think that we can't have everyone in the group voicing their opinions, you know, sort of building on from the psychological safety discussion we just had, you know, the leaders setting the environment, people within the group, you know, the followers, let's call them that for today, you know, not everyone's comfortable in voicing their opinion. It could be a rank mismatch. You could be new to a group. You might not want to sort of stick your head above the parapet, so to say. You know, so then how do we set the environment for that? Is there, I suppose, the need for decisive action there? Or what does a follower say at that point? Like, how do they strategize and then voice their opinions within the group?
So I think I'm going to make 2 points on this. Yeah. I think what people need to realise that a lot of leaders will go, I don't want everyone speaking up.
Yes.
But you have to remember that psych safety is the speaking up only in the best interest of the group. It's not speaking up to be, you know, like, I don't know, provocative victim or vexatious or like personal gain, or, you know, or trying to like cause trouble. Yeah. Psych safety is common good. And, you know, I think that, you know, there is a tension between leaders wanting to have, you know, the power. Like sometimes, you know, like you said, in time-sensitive situations or when there's the need for decisive action, like there should be that hierarchical leadership. But then what I'm saying is that it needs to be, you know, psych safety where there's more of a egalitarian type leadership. And I think what good leader does is they know how to oscillate between the two. So I just want to bring up this really interesting research where these researchers did an analysis. I think it was like over 5,000 Himalayan mountain climbing expeditions. So this is involving over 30,000 people. And interestingly, they found that the climbing troops who had more hierarchical, more, you know, command and control structures, they had more people reach the summit, but they had a lot more people die.
Oh, okay.
The ones that were in the more egalitarian low power distance where people felt safe to speak up, a lot less people died. So, like, to bring back to you guys, like, do you want less people to die under your watch?
Of course, yeah, of course.
Yeah, so, you know, like, I suppose what the question is, like, how do you create it? Like, what can you do practically as a leader to make sure that there's psych safety in your organization? And there's some good tips. So I'll start with one of them. We know this is one of the most effective ways is to articulate belonging indicators.
Okay.
So this goes back to that primitive brain again. And so what belonging indicators are, they provide clear messages that that you're, you know, you're one of us.
Yep.
Here is a safe place to give it effort. It's going to be seen and heard. It's going to be rewarded. And the way you do this, so there's all the body language cues. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, eye contact and, you know, taps on the shoulder, all the active listening stuff. But actually it's more about what you say. And it's really like a, you know, steady pulse of interactions that frequently and authentically say, hey, you're one of us. And you can actually use this when you're giving, you know, constructive criticism or when you're doing performance reviews. You can say, like, here's an example. You can say to someone, hey, I'm giving you this feedback because you're part of our team and, you know, we, so you're using those group identifiers, our, we, us.
Yes.
So I know we have high standards and I know you can reach them.
Gotcha.
And what's even better and more effective at creating psych safety is using future belonging indicators. So this would sound like, you know, I think this advice would be super helpful to you in the future when I get you to run that exercise or that mission next, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You know, you can understand that. What it does, these statements sort of answer that ancient question like, am I safe? You know, what's my future with these people? You know, can we face dangers together?
Yes, yeah.
So you can see, does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it definitely does. It's fascinating to be able to have the time to discuss this, you know, and for our listeners listening in here today as well to go through it in detail. You know, you've raised some very good points so far today, and I'll sort of link a few things together if I can. You know, we're talking there, you know, setting the trust within the team. You know, there's certain actions a leader has to do, and we spoke through, you know, the ABC approach that there. There's actions that the follower has to do, you know, and that's really, I suppose, critically thinking about what's occurring within the group, strategizing their thoughts and their input, you know, to really voice their opinions or voice their position, but without constantly calling out the leader or having an opposing point of view. But to build, you know, that trust, you know, and to build that environment, it takes time, right? And we need to, as leaders, you know, to build that environment for our followers, take some risk here and there, you know. But if we spend the time, we understand the group, we build that sense of belonging, that then, you know, turns into your psychological safety, which you spoke about. And then that would probably really set us up for, you know, uncertain operating environments, you know, using a terminology VUCA, for example, volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity environments. You know, and we spoke in our opening address there, you know, preparing an army for accelerated warfare. You know, with everything we've discussed so far today, Jem, what are your thoughts then on, well, firstly, if I can ask you to unpick VUCA for me, and then how do we, as an army, and then within that, you know, as a leader and a follower, really set ourselves up to operate in those environments?
Yeah, this is a really good question, really pertinent in these environments at the moment. So what I'll do, I'll just break down VUCA.
Yeah, great.
Potentially the neuroscience that's happening in your brain and what you can do about it. So
thank you.
So VUCA is any situation where, like, there's volatility. So there's changes that are occurring at fairly high speed, and then there's uncertainty. So uncertainty is where, like, our normal models that we've used to, you know, understand and operate in the world just don't work anymore. Like, we've got no idea. Like, this is a definitely uncertain time because we've got no idea what works and what doesn't. And then there's, like, complexity. So it's the degree of special training or technological sophistication has actually, you know, surpassed the processing of any single human brain. So, you know, 1 liter can't get it all. And then there's ambiguity. So that means there's sort of views that are happening around us, and, you know, particularly for the army, like, the army members themselves are becoming less homogenous and more diverse, and there's no one way of looking at something, and then people are bringing their backgrounds.
Yep.
So I think, you know, we can say that we're living in VUCA times, which, you know, requires pretty specialised effective teaming. And leaders have now got to lead and make decisions in environments where they may only have finite knowledge of, like, the areas of expertise that are required. So, for instance, you know, cyber intelligence, human terrain, counterinsurgency, like, or engineering stuff. Like, you've got to know it all.
Yeah.
And it's really hard for you to proficient in all of these domains. Mm-hmm. So what you actually need to do now is be able to safely and smoothly oscillate between that more hierarchical leadership style, when you've got time pressure and, you know, you've got to be decisive, to more of an egalitarian leadership style, when you have to draw on the technical capabilities of the team member, and you've got to say, hey, you can take the lead, you know, you know more about this than I do. But, you know, that takes, like, safety, and it takes a leader to give up their ego and say, hey, you know better than me, right? So
you really
quite
sort
hard
of,
to do.
Well, of course, yeah, it would be tough, especially when we're used to leading in a certain way within a military context or environment. But it goes back to that setting the conditions, doesn't it, as the leader, you know, understanding who's in your team, what their skill sets are. Building those agile and adaptable teams that you can then, you know, throw at a mission set or throw at a problem set, but draw from the group the expertise to inform the way forward or to inform the decision.
Yeah, I totally agree with this. And I think there's nothing more powerful when you when a leader shows great strength and says, look, I don't have the balls to, you know, I've got the balls to say, I don't know. I'm authentic, you know, about my weaknesses, on my vulnerabilities, and I'm not going to try and cover it up and just basically say, hey, guys, don't know, what do you think? And then, like, because there's no way that, you know, officers can really be an expert in everything, because you're posting in and out every 2 years. So you know, you're not going to have the technical expertise. So I think, you know, followers really want to know that the leader's not going to put them at risk because they're worried about saving space.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's really important that that people are okay with saying, I don't know, because, you know, when you get into a stress state and, you know, your brain gets activated, either the leader feels threatened about a new environment, or then the subordinates don't really trust the leader, happens is, you know, you get this amygdala hijack and you actually lose IQ points. So if people feel like their position in a team, and that goes for a leader, they've shown on tests that you actually lose IQ points in terms of short-term memory and decision-making. And that, you know, you produce cortisol, stress hormones. And so when you've got that in your brain, you're definitely more reactive, more myopic.
Yep.
You actually shut down your logic and reasoning. And that takes up a lot of cognitive real estate, you know, all of those stress thoughts about, you know, am I being perceived as a good leader?
Yep.
Or the subordinates going, oh, am I part of this team? And so pretty much, you know, your team's running around on half of the brain. So, it's super important to create that psych safety.
Yes.
So you can, you know, have trust in yourself, trust in the team, and then you can, you know, seamlessly move between those leadership styles so you can be prepared for that VUCA environment, which is, you know, incredibly uncertain.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's not easy though, is it? I mean, you're looking at the VUCA environment there. You're looking at applying the right leadership style or technique to the specific situation you're going into, and that might change, you know, day to day or week to week. But it's important to know yourself as a leader, being self-aware, so, you know, knowing how you're going to react to an environment. But importantly, I suppose you were saying there as well, don't always be afraid as a leader to show some vulnerability, so shared vulnerability. Like you said, you know, you might not always have the answers. You know, by saying that to your group who you've spent time developing and building, that in turn speeds up trust, right?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, if you can say, I don't know, what do you think? People really appreciate that.
Yeah, it gives you buy-in into the problem at hand. So, Jem, hey, look, we spent a fair bit of time talking about how to build trust, you know, how to build psychological safety, some leader and follower behaviours there, etc. So then from your point of view, what prohibits inter-team cohesion? So we've gone all the way to build it up and we think we've got it pretty good. How quickly can we break it down and sort of affect the good work we've done there?
This is also a really good question. So to answer this, I have to go back to the biochemistry and evolutionary history. And we know that Mother Nature is a great way of punishing behaviours that would potentially lead to our death, like not being part of the team, and rewarding those behaviours that would lead to great group success, or what we'd call pro-social team behaviours.
Okay.
And involved, and it's called oxytocin. So have you heard of oxytocin?
I have, but if you can unpack it more for us, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah, so this is an amazing chemical. So people might know it as the attachment hormone, but it does so much more than this. So it's basically, yeah, Mother Nature's reward to make us be nice to each other. And it does lots of things. So it makes us want more social interaction. It actually improves your memory.
Okay.
It improves your attachment. It improves your ability to read emotions on other faces.
Yes.
It increases your situational awareness and in body postures of your team.
Okay.
It's a buffer against social stress, so it has antidepressant effects. It increases pain tolerance, which is really good in your job.
Yep.
And it also increases your motivation to work within the team. So it's essential for building trust.
Right,
and,
okay.
So this is the hormone you want. You want more of it. And there's this really interesting phenomenon that this combination of oxytocin plus testosterone creates this state we call the collective challenge state. It's really fascinating. So it's when like high testosterone alpha men work together in dangerous environments for a common goal, and often, you know, against a common enemy or a common problem.
Yeah.
This creates this like an intoxicating biochemical combination of emotion, and it's often referred to as war love. So it's, you know, it's described by guys like it's like nothing they've ever felt before, and they would literally say I would die for my oppo. I will, you know, I would do anything to protect him in the fight.
Yeah.
May not necessarily have a beer with him on the weekend, but in that moment I'd fight for the death.
Of course.
This is this, you know, collective challenge state, this oxytocin plus testosterone kept our primitive ancestors alive.
Yeah,
so it's a really great state to be in because it makes you fight through terrible situations together. But just going back to oxytocin on its own, it actually can have a dark side.
Right.
And, you know, you ask, Sam, you asked the question, like, what prohibits inter-team cohesion?
Yeah.
Well, oxytocin can do this. So we know that it can increase your in-group bias, so your in-group favoritism. So you say, I love my brothers, they're everything to me, but those guys over there on that other team, I hate them and I don't want to work with them. And it can create jealousy and it can actually create out-group derogation.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so this is the hormone that makes you tight, makes you insular, makes you a really formidable fighting force, but it also can make you very difficult to work with if you're not part of the in-group. So it kind of might explain why some, you know, particular units have trouble working together. And I think you need to be very aware of this.
Yep. And I couldn't imagine it'd be easier to break down those stovepipes either. I'm sure those barriers, you know, you form a tight bond as a group, you know, you realise success through the group, therefore become proud of the group and want to achieve more. But then it'd be quite a strong barrier, I'd imagine, between you and others.
Yeah, definitely. And so the great thing is that we're really smart humans.
Yep.
People in leadership positions have this big prefrontal cortex that is actually designed to override these types of primitive drivers. And so, you know, if you want to increase inter-team effectiveness, between your group and another group, there's a formula for doing this, and we can go through this if you like.
Yeah, let's do it.
So so for you as a leader, I know often you guys have got to work with, like, you know, other government agencies or, you know, even non-government agencies, and from an outsider, sometimes when you're faced with this sea of uniforms, big guys, you know, for people who are not in the military, it can be quite overwhelming. So, you know, and if you've got to work with that group, it's really important, you know, going back to that neuroscience, that you've got to placate that primitive brain. And as a leader, you've got to find ways to create quick trust.
Yeah.
You may be working with these people just, you know, for a short time, or, you know, you've got to get on with the job really quickly, but it's essential that you create the quick trust first before you can go on and do the things that make you so competent. So,
of course.
There's a really great way to create instant trustworthiness, and it's mention a weakness or a drawback in the first instance. So in doing this, what you're doing is you're creating instant credibility so that everything after that you say is seen as trustworthy.
Yep.
And so, like, I don't know, like if you walk into a room, you can joke about how maybe, I don't know, you're a bad shot and that you actually need, you know, people like you around so you can protect, or I don't know, you've got to come up with something that's authentic.
Yes, yeah.
But still kind of, you know, breaks down that barrier of, like, I'm a big, competent, formidable force. You know, you need to get into that human touch.
Yeah, so almost making light humour of the situation to sort of break down some barriers and build some human understanding there.
Definitely, yeah. You have to do it. Otherwise, that person that you're talking to is, like, their primitive brain scanning, like, is he dangerous? Is it, you know, like,
of course.
He's not one of me. He's so different from me. He's got a uniform on. He does different things to me.
Yep,
so you've absolutely got to try and create likeness. So all, you know, we're very diverse humans, but you can find something that's similar to another human if you try. So even something like you're both parents or you like the same sport, it's of critical importance that you find likeness in the first, you know, couple of minutes of interaction.
Yeah, so you're really building that common understanding between the two. You're finding something that you can leverage off or work discuss together on to break down some of those initial barriers. And let's be honest, we all make assumptions and we all have a bias towards people when we first meet them.
Yeah, Yeah, particularly in the military. And so, like, when you walk into an office or walk into an environment, you scan their office and say, oh, look, they've got a picture of fishing on the wall. And then you talk about fishing. And you actually have to spend time engaging in that social lubrication. Like, a lot of people think, oh, you know, blah, blah, waste of time. It's really important because unless you do that, they will not really trust you, or they will feel separate from you, and they won't work with you.
Yeah.
And another thing you should do, like when you've got two teams coming together, you need to actually just tell them you are now part of this team. Give it a name and give them a sense of cohesion. Just by naming it, you know, research has shown that people will cooperate with that team, even if they've been in that team for a few minutes or if they've just seen them on Zoom.
Yeah.
Actually naming we are a team, using us, we, now, you know, words is really effective. You wouldn't think so, but and then they start to filter out the out group indicators, and they don't see that, you know, the different, you know, race or sex or jobs. They're starting to look for in group indicators. So that's one is to, you know, try to get quick trust, try to look for similarity, try to name the team together.
Yeah.
And then the third one is to articulate a sense of purpose, that you've got a common goal, which is kind of, you know, everyone knows that. Another one is to create external competition.
Oh, okay.
Very, very effective way to create in-group cohesion is to have an object of, enemy or situation that you guys have to battle against together.
Of course.
Really effective at doing that. And like, so you can, I don't know, doing sport, you know, like a game of cricket or anything that you know, has an external we need to work together to beat, super effective. Yep. And so you could make it fun. It doesn't have to always be like an enemy situation.
No, of course.
The last one is create moments that allow you to secrete oxytocin.
Okay.
So you put the groups together with physical proximity, this is post-COVID, of course, eye contact, shoulder taps, you engage in reciprocity.
Yes.
So you give like a small concession, like you'll say, okay, we'll come to your office to meet. Like that small concession creates really good faith. And then humor. Humor's so good at creating oxytocin, and even dark humor is even better. And then with that, you know, that's how you can create inter-team cohesiveness really quickly.
Yeah.
Those points.
Hey, Gemma, that's fantastic. Thank you. So, five very quick, handy hints there for all of our leaders listening in today to sort of develop their teams moving forward. And look, there's things we can practice every day, right? We don't need to be on the battlefield. We don't need to be getting ready to go on deployment. You know, we can practice this at work, in a staff environment, on the sporting pitch, etc., going through. And importantly, like you said before, look, we post every couple of years. You know, there's a chance there every single time to build and develop your new team, whether you're the appointed leader or part of that team.
Yeah, you guys get heaps of practice at this, coming into new teams. And, you know, if you do it right, you can be really effective at it.
Yeah, fantastic. And it's all about applying the right leadership to the right situation. You know, there's no sort of one set answer that's going to get us through every problem set we find, but it's about being astute enough to identify the right one. Hey.
Yeah, and I think if you just remember that there's really basic, primitive human behaviours that are bolstered by neural architecture that are at play now. And if you are aware of those and then you know how to use those, you know, you can be, you know, super effective. And just knowing that psych safety and trust is paramount, it will put you in good stead.
Fantastic. Hey, Gemma, thank you very much for your time today and for really, you know, speaking with us on some of those key topics we unpicked today. You know, we spoke in detail there about understanding the neurobiology of effective teaming, you know, really the importance that the trust, rapport and psychological safety mean to the group, you know, and then that allows us to then operate in those uncertain, complex and ambiguous environments as well. Of particular note, I thoroughly enjoyed your five factors to increase team effectiveness. I'll use those in many postings to come and with it, many new teams that I have, and I'll practice it to see the results as I get better at moving forward. Hey, thank you again for your time. It was great to have you on the show. It was much appreciated.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. Always a pleasure, and good luck.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And listen, to our listeners out there, that's all we have time for today, unfortunately. I look forward to you joining us on our next podcast from the Centre for Australian Army Leadership.